on Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. Thank you very much. Present with us today are Representative Johnson, Representative Seaton, Vice Chair Wilson, Co-Chair Feige, and Co-Chair Sadler. We have a quorum to conduct business. And Representative Kawasaki has joined us. Okay, kill your cell phones. We have a busy agenda today. Three bills. First one, House Bill 135, Petersville Recreational Mining Area. Second is House Bill 161, Auctions for Big Game Harvest Permits. And House Joint Resolution 26, Offshore Oil and Gas Revenue Sharing. I would invite the sponsor's representative to the table with his lifelines to present HB 135. Gentlemen, you're with the drill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Poundstaff, Representative Keller, who apologizes for not being here, but he has judiciary down the hall.
I understand.
And it's a little busy. House Bill 135, if I could, is legislation that will fix several problems, hopefully. It will allow the state to fulfill an agreement that it made back in the 90s. It's a good faith transaction that was made between the state and a potential business owner. It's an agreement that cannot be finalized until HB 135's language becomes statute. Without getting into the details of the history, HB 135 will allow the state to obtain federal land that it has selected, about 220 acres of land. In theory, it will then be up to the State Department to process and determine how that land will be used in the future. More than likely as recreational mining in an area that is currently being somewhat managed by the stakeholder who has historic sites, buildings and sites and equipment from mining in that area from a day gone by. HB 135 could well become the home of a mining museum, also an opportunity for locals and tourists alike to go out and do a little bit of gold panning without having to worry about jumping on someone else's claim. Mm-hmm. So, for that, I'd like your support for HB 135. With me is Greg Goodrum from the Department of Natural Resources, the Director of Mining, Water, and Land, and he certainly can answer your questions a lot better than I can, to be honest.
Thank you, Mr. Pound. Questions for the sponsor, Representative Senator Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to clarify what I heard in statement was that we pass this bill and then it will be up to the department to decide the uses. And because what I'm reading is this is reserving from all uses that would be incompatible with a recreational mining district. So I just want to make sure we're clear on the record as to what the bill does and what it allows the department to do.
For the record, Brent Goodrum, Director of the Division of Mining, Land and Water within the Department of Natural Resources. If you look closely at the bill, the language in the bill, what the bill seeks to do is remove the southern portion of the Petersville Recreational Mining Area. House Bill 46 was passed in May of 1997, signed into law, which created a recreational mining area in Petersville in the Upper Susitna Valley. The northern Petersville Recreational Area, approximately 280 acres, is currently open and active. That came into state ownership. The southern portion, the South Petersville Recreational Area, an area of approximately 220 acres, is still federal land. It's state-selected land. And what this bill seeks to do is to remove that southern portion from the recreational mining area.
Good. Follow up, or?
Follow up. I'm reading page 1F. Are we on the A version? Just to make sure that I'm correct. It says the vacant and unappropriated state-owned land, water, and state land and water acquired in the future that lie within the described mining claims are reserved from all uses incompatible with the purposes of this section and are assigned to the Department for Control and Management. And the title says reserve an act relating to the reservation of certain mining claims from all uses incompatible with the purposes for establishing a Petersville recreational mining area. And I'm hearing verbally something that doesn't quite align in my mind with that. So I just want to get clarification.
And I'll take this opportunity to note for the record, Representative Tarr has joined us, and to acknowledge Representatives Josephson and Gaddis have joined us in the audience.
Thank you.
through the chair, Representative Seaton, the aspect that I'm focusing on, and if you look at the actual bill, you'll note that what it does is this is the language for the creation of the Petersville Recreational Mining Area, and what happens in the actual bill is there are sections that are removed from it. Those are the sections that comprise the southern portion of the recreational mining area.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was reading the bill and trying to figure it out from the title, and I understand now.
And for the record, we are actually correct. We are in version A of House Bill 135. Other questions for the sponsor or the director? Okay, great. If not, then I would open public testimony on House Bill 135. Is there anybody in person who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will ask, do we have anybody online? We do. Do you have anybody? Stand by one second here. Okay, great. Okay, these are folks off net. Okay, we'll start at the top of the list. We have, what's that? Okay, fair enough. We have Michelle Stevens, who is on the telephone line from Petersville. Ms. Stevens, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Great. Do you want to go ahead with your public testimony? Just identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
My name's Michelle Stevens, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I'm not sure if you want me to read. Does everybody have my narrative there?
I believe so, yes, ma'am.
Do you want me to read the entire narrative, or would you just like to ask any questions?
If you could sum it up in one paragraph or two, don't read the whole thing, but just kind of give us a short version of the history.
Well, back in the 90s, Jules Tileson and I I gifted about 500 acres of federal mining claims or state mining claims to the state of Alaska with the hope that I would be able to have a recreational mining operation there, because during those times it was illegal to have any recreational mining on mining claims. So we went through legislation and passed House Bill 46, and ever since then the Department of Lands has not been able to come up with a conclusion for us to go forward with our agreement. So by lifting the verbiage, as House Bill 135 would do, it would revert the mining claims back to me, and then I could probably proceed forward with a new mechanism, which would be a state, it would be a mining lease that I could get from the state of Alaska that would allow me to proceed forward. In 2012, there was some questions about whether the land would revert back to me. So since then, I've remedied the situation by putting in some amendments over the top of the Peters Creek claims, and in the event that House Bill 135 passes, the land will automatically revert back to me, and then the state and I could move forward with our agreement in a different manner.
Good deal. Thank you, Ms. Stevens. That's a good summation of things. For the record, we've been joined by Representative Hawker. I guess I got a question for the, and I'm sorry, other questions for the public testifier, Ms. Stevens? If not, then I'm going to ask a question of you, Michelle. So this bill basically puts us on a path back forward to all parties involved to fulfill the intent of their agreements many years ago. This bill clears the way forward to what we wanted to do in the first place. Is that correct? Ms. Stevens? Did we lose her?
They muted me. Sorry, I'm back. yes, it would put us on a different path. That a couple of individuals in the past, Steve Hirschbaugh, has blazed some trails by working with the Division of Lands to work with land leases, and this would put us in a different direction so that the state and I could move forward.
Question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, and at this time it says that there's a zero fiscal note on the bill itself, but are you intending, is the state of Alaska going to be spending money, or are you expecting to ask the state of Alaska for any money or anything?
No, the state of Alaska will not do any. It will not put any money in here. In fact, they would gain revenue by allowing me to operate my business.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good deal. And one last question, Mrs. Stevens. Just to give us a brief outline of what your hopes and intentions are for your recreational mining activity.
I'd like to have my buildings were built in 1936. And I have a Marion shovel that built the Panama Canal and came up and built the Alaska Railroad and also did mining for Petersville. So I would like to take all the relics and everything and possibly have a museum and open up the creek area for people to come and do some gold panning and a picnic area for people to just relax and have a good time.
Good deal. Thank you very much. If no other questions for you, but thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go off net again to Jules Tilliston. Jules, can you hear us?
This is Jules Tilliston. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Jules Tilliston. Thank you, sir. Just give us your name and any affiliation and give us your testimony.
I'm a private citizen, but at 21 years ago, I was the director of mining and water management when this whole situation started. I submitted testimony yesterday by fax to you and the co-chair and Representative Keller. I would be glad to answer any questions you have, but I do strongly support this bill as written.
Thank you, Mr. Tilston. We did receive that testimony. Are there questions for him from anybody in the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in my mind, what I'm envisioning based on Ms. Stevens' comments is like what happens at Crow Creek Mine. And is that what you see happening here if we pass this legislation?
That's affirmative. The only difference between Crow Creek Mine and this area, Crow Creek Mine is private land, completely owned under the federal mining laws by the Crow Creek Group. This mining claim would be managed and under the final jurisdiction of the state of Alaska through DNR.
But you could still get married there, right? Okay. Women's other questions? Other questions? Seeing and hearing no. Thank you very much, Jules, for your testimony. Is there anybody else online who would like to testify? Seeing none, and no one's come in the time since. Okay, we will close public testimony on House Bill 135 and ask for comments or questions from committee members. Seeing none.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and this is to anyone who might answer. Is this accessible by road?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, there is a road that is close in proximity to the southern Petersville recreational mining area. So, yes, there is a road in close proximity.
To define close proximity, Alaska close is different than within 100 miles is close in Alaska.
Right. I don't know if Michelle's online through the chair, Representative Johnson, but I do believe depicted on one of your maps, you can see very roughly there's a Petersville Road, very faint little line that shows where it's at, but I can get you the exact distances.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, my question is, what kind of business opportunity and clientele are you looking at? Is it a tourist opportunity? So I'm just kind of looking at what kind of business plan is laid out here for recreational mining. Is it recreational so that one person can recreate and put money in their pocket, or is it recreational so that, what's the business plan for this? What's it going to look like in 10 years?
Right. Through the chair, and it comes, and obviously that would come from the applicant. Currently, the land is still federal land. We have to go through the process of bringing it over into conveyance, a number of steps that would need to happen, but we would work with the potential applicant on their business plan and how those rules would play out. But all of that, this is the first important step in moving in that direction to kind of untangle this situation has a bunch of complexity to it. So I think all that information would be forthcoming in the future, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Seeing one more question?
Yeah, Representative, this is for Brent. The
legal services drafted a memo asking, the one question that was asked was why the mining claims were excluded from this bill as listed, and why was it drafted in that way?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the entire area was at one point state selected land with federal mining claims previously located there. There was a mineral survey that was done in, I believe, 1984, which prevented the state from taking ownership of that. Those federal mining claims, before they came patented, became abandoned. So our state selection still hovered over top. And so the state had still had the ability to bring it into to ownership. During that mineral survey, that land was surveyed, and so the easiest way for them to reference back to and identify this area was to reference those surveys that were done in 1984. And so that's how the Petersville Recreational Mining Area was created. It leveraged those surveys that were already in place, and that's why those particular claims are referenced.
Okay. And then just another question along the same lines. So are there any current federal claims on that land that are active, or I don't know what the status would be?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, to my knowledge, there are no current federal claims that are active in that area.
Okay. Just another question, doing something different.
Different question, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In general, it's a 500 acres. I'm just looking at the map. It's hard to tell where the acreage exactly is. But, I guess my question about a recreational claim versus other types of claims that are out there, just in your opinion, is this the best use of the land? If it were to revert back, it's currently in state hands. Is it conceivable that there's more than just a recreational use for the land? I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, those are several steps down the road, and I think the state will be in the process of figuring out what's the best use of that land, and I'm sure that they'll be in conversations with the potential applicant to talk about what type of activities would be appropriate there. And so I think that those decisions are still in front of us, but it's clearly paves the way for the state to follow through on what had been originally conceived as far as what could be done with this area.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilson?
Is it all right if I move?
I believe so. Seeing no other questions, what is the will of the committee?
Okay, I move House Bill 135, Version A, with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
So, any objection? With no objection, House Bill 135, Version A, passes out. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Right back.
Thank you.
We are back on the record at 1:49 p.m. Thank you, Jim and Brent. Up next, we have House Bill 161, Auctions for Big Game Harvest Permits.
Yeah.
Invite the sponsor to come up. We have actually heard in the committee House Bill 161 and did hold it back in April with the sponsor's commitment to go back and work on the bill. She is back to us with a CS, so I'm going to ask you to put yourself on the record and explain the changes in the bill since we last met.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill again. My name is Representative Lynn Gaddis. I represent District 9, the Greater Wasilla Area. And I thank you again for hearing this bill again. As members of the committee may recall, and as the chair indicated, that we had some work to do on this House Bill 161 after its hearing last year. Staff and I have worked with the Department of Fish and Game, as well as a number of sporting groups, to create the work draft hopefully you have in front of you.
Yes.
I would like to ask the committee to adopt this House Bill 161 Version Y so I can speak to it.
Certainly. Would you like to discuss the changes?
Sure. I'll go ahead.
Adopt it. So, right. What's the will of the committee?
Move it.
Mr. Chairman, I
move
that we adopt Version Y as a working document.
Object.
Objection from Representative Kawasaki. Okay, in that case, would you present the differences and we'll take up
I
the
will.
Adoption to CS?
As a refresher, the department operates several programs where big game permits are donated for auction or raffle by nonprofit sporting groups to support state wildlife management. Three separate auction programs are authorized in statute: Delta Bison, Edelin Elk, and Big Game. The current statutory framework governing the two most prominent programs, Delta Bison and Big Game, is dated, and many groups have become ambivalent about participating. The new version of HB 161 expands the scope of the program. HB 161 allows for more permits to be issued for more species, from 19 permits in statute to 42 permits under this bill. It further invigorates the program by giving the nonprofit organization a greater share of the proceeds from the auction of the permit. Quite frankly, there were not enough folks getting involved at 10%. So with a greater share, it was felt that there would be more involved, and it would be worth their while. And the changes in the definition for which nonprofits can auction off permits from, fish and game enforcement to, education in outdoor traditions and conservation and wildlife protection programs in partnership with the department. There are two types of permits that can be issued under this bill. Permits under Section 1 give 100% of the proceeds from the auction to the sporting group operating the auction, and permits under Section 2 allocate 30% of the proceeds to sporting groups, while the other 70% is retained by the department and deposited in the Fish and Game Fund. From 2009 to 2013, the sale of these permits brought in $460,000 in revenue. This money is deposited in the Fish and Game Fund and is used to directly benefit purchasers of general hunting, fishing, and trapping licenses. Mr. Chair, you may take note that the North American model has been removed from HB 161. This language brought some confusion that, quite frankly, was never the point of this original bill. I thank you for hearing this, and I brought Reed Harris, my staff, who can assist with any technical questions as we move through this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Gaddis. Are there questions for the sponsor of the bill? Hearing none, then I will open public testimony on the bill. Do we have anybody in the room with us today who'd like to testify on House Bill 161? Seeing none, we do currently have some folks who are online, so we will go all the way up to Fairbanks LIO. Mr. Wayne Heimer, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, if you can put yourself on the record and who you might be affiliated with, then give us your testimony.
Great, thank you. My name is Wayne Heimer. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm testifying for myself. I think you might find what I have to say relevant because of my experience with the permit auction system. This system has, I'll give you a little history that you may find intriguing, if not particularly helpful. The system has always existed. It existed throughout the western states, particularly as a form of political patronage, where the governor would have the opportunity to give permits away for hunting and fishing to get stuff done, one way or another. Alaska had a permit system very much like this, but it was withdrawn by the legislature in the 1960s after Governor Egan issued a governor's permit for the taking of Dall sheep in the Brooks Range by the nephew of the Shah of Iran, who really was there to steal peregrine falcons, which were then considered endangered. So we did not have this for a decade or two. The idea of using these governor's permits for conservation arose in Wyoming, and at the time that happened, I was the Dall sheep research biologist at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I was probably the first person in Alaska to advocate for using this business to raise conservation money. At that point, the Department of Fish and Game was pointedly not interested in it, and I shifted the project over to what was then the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, now known as the Wild Sheep Foundation. The Alaska chapter had a gentleman named Ken Wynn who worked with Senator Bundy, and they got the law that we are considering amending passed. I've served three terms on the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep Foundation boards, which is where the big dollars come from these permits. The Dall sheep ones are where the big money is, and I've been up to my ears in that for 15 years. I also served as the Alaska chapter president and have been involved in getting these Dall sheep permits to market and advertised and sold in the days when they weren't quite as attractive as they are now. I am opposed to House Bill 161 because I think basically the premises upon which it is based are highly questionable. The idea that the permit system is a golden goose from which you can repeatedly squeeze eggs as long as you can get hold of the goose, I think is false. Permits are, the auction prices for these are extremely variable by as much as 100% from a few years to a few years. Sometimes they bring very big dollars, sometimes they don't. The buyers typically state that they want to give back to the resource that they enjoy, and they certainly do, but they are still in the business of looking for an unusual animal, and they will pay no more than the guy that is bidding against them is willing to pay. This is a pretty volatile market, and the idea that you can simply put more permits out there and maintain the price is an assumption that I question. I also question the rationale or the ethos behind this bill. I like amateur NGOs, not industrial ones. The Wild Sheep Foundation, I think, is basically an amateur NGO. I like the permit to auction proceedings or proceeds to capitalize not the NGOs but the managers. The idea that we should have, say, one doll sheep permit that goes specifically to NGOs for education and so forth seems to me to presume that that will provide more benefits in the long run than capitalizing the managers who produce the benefits from that resource under our Constitution and our statutes. I've found in my experience with NGOs that they often begin to confuse themselves with the managers. They are not. They're there to support the managers and try and help the managers find their way. Those things really give me to question the basic premise of House Bill 161. And I think maybe it would be, we're going to end up, somebody's going to end up marketing these permits, and it's going to be a lot of work. If you do a good job, you might be able, might earn 30% of it, but would that 30% really be better spent by the agency providing benefits or by the overhead of non-governmental organizations? That concludes what I have prepared to tell you. If you have things that you'd like to ask, I'll be glad to do my best.
Thank you, Mr. Heimer. Did you send any written comments in by chance?
I did last April, but I did not this time. Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you. Good deal. Okay. Do you have a question, Representative Seaton?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out, is the main objection that expanding the number of permits this much will deflate the value of them in the, I think what I was hearing was a pretty small market?
Yes, that's one of my concerns, a major one. The buyers of these permits at auction really appreciate the appearance of exclusivity. I think economists may call that snob goods or something like that, and that is a big factor.
Good deal. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So essentially what you said, what you were saying is that the NGOs or these organizations, instead of doing what their organization says it's doing, they're really end up paying for the managers and not actually doing what the organization purports to be organized for.
I think there is some risk of that. The point I had hoped to make would be perhaps illustrated if we say there were $100,000 that a permit would bring. If 30% were to go to the marketing NGO, for that to be a net benefit to the state, we would have to figure that the NGO is going to produce more benefits with that $30,000 than the managers would produce with that $30,000. I think that's a very questionable assumption that the NGOs, and that, you know, they will spend it on overhead. Executive directors cost money. Sometimes board members cost money. Travel costs money. There are a lot of expense in being a not-for-profit organization.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Any questions, Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chair, and I'm hearing the 30%. As I read the bill here on page 2, lines 13 and 14.
And version Y?
Version Y.
Version Y, okay.
It's after, in addition to the administrative costs of the auction, then 30% of the net proceeds. So I just wanted to clarify that that's what intended. So whatever it costs to conduct the auction and the marketing and all that kind of stuff comes off the top, and then an additional 30% of the net profits. And I just getting clarification from the sponsor.
Thank you. That troubles me even more.
Thank you. Would the sponsor care to address that question? Or?
Well, I guess I don't quite understand, or I think I do understand, either one. With that being said, anybody who has organized fundraisers, and that's really what this is about, specifically the 30%, it's about making it worthwhile for fundraisers to get out there and do this business of fundraising. It becomes a win-win when the fundraiser is able to get more for the permit. Certainly we get more for the state, but there's more for the agency. The net proceeds, I think that's what we're really discussing, whether it's a net or gross, and that becomes, you know, a matter of question. But again, I think that the net proceeds allow the state to get their take, which is 70%, and 30% for the agency. So we found that when there were at 10%, people were just not going out there doing it. So again, it costs money to do this type of a thing, so that's why we increased that.
Thank you, President Gaddis. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my question is to the sponsor, Fishing Game, or whoever can answer it. This is one permit out of many permits in an area, or several permits within an area, but it's a guaranteed permit as opposed to a drawing or however else it was chosen. Is that the way I understand this?
Well, guaranteed in, through the chair, guaranteed in the sense that the highest bidder.
They get a there's a permit guarantee.
That's correct.
So my question is, all those other permits that are in the same area, how much does the state make that aren't auctioned off?
I'm going to let my staff, my lifeline, help me with that.
Give us yourself a name of the record. Reed.
Good afternoon. Through the chair, my name is Reed Harris, staff to Representative Gaddis. Representative Johnson, I think Douglas Vincent Lang from ADF&G would be more qualified to answer that than myself. I think part of the question you're getting at, though, is this a guaranteed permit? The answer is yes. Possibly the second part of the question you're getting to is where that permit come from.
I'll state my question more clearly, I think. My question is, how much do we make off a permit that's drawn as opposed to a permit that's sold?
And make sure you address the chair through the...
Mr. Chairman.
You.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'll deflect that one to Douglas Vincent.
I think I know the answer, but I want it on the record.
And at that, I think I'd like to call Doug Vincent Lang with ADF&G, who's online from Fairbanks. Doug, have you heard the question?
Could you just repeat it again?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug, Representative Johnson, and I want to use a hypothetical. Let's say there are 10 permits in an area. One of them is not auctioned off. And of those other 9 permits that weren't auctioned off, be they through drawing or however, how much does the state make on those permits?
We only make the amount of money equivalent to what's bought back in terms of a license to go hunt that species and the application fee to enter the drawing.
So that's in, Mr. Chairman, if I might, so that's a price of a hunting fee and $25 or $50 depending on the entry fee for the permit?
Through the chair, that's correct.
So have you ever, and I'm going to ask one more question if I could, Mr. Chairman, have you ever seen a drawing that made less than $50?
Through the chair, no.
So to compare this with just a regular hunt is in terms of putting money in the treasury to preserve fishing game, this is a no-brainer, in my opinion. If it sells for $100,000 and we get 70% of $100,000, even if it's 50%, cost, we're still getting $50,000 as opposed to $50. I went to public school, but I understand the difference between those numbers, and this is an opportunity for us to put money into the Treasury to help preserve species, and we're talking about one permit per area per species. So to me, this is, if you want to put this on economics, I think we just need to look at the difference in what we'd get if we just had a drawing versus auctioned it off. But I also don't think we're having a huge impact on any species with one permit. So, Mr. Chairman, this to me is a pretty much a no-brainer. We're just making it equitable for someone or economic for someone to actually go through the process of making money for the state.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And for the record, Doug, could you give us your name and title just for the record, retroactively?
Yeah. This is Doug Vincent-Lang. I'm the director for the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and yeah, I'm stationed in Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Question, Representative Wilson?
Yes. I guess I'm a little bit confused because you said one permit of one species, but some of them are more than that. Four elk from the Edelin Island herd. So there's, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is, okay, how many does the state, you know, for instance, on that, because I know where that's at, how many does the state issue there, and then how many are going to be auctioned off?
There's a number of permits in the game management system that says we're going to allow X number of animals out of this herd, and out of that they would take a number and use it for the governor's choice auction, and the rest of it would go to citizens during the normal process. It won't affect the numbers, so it depends on each individual herd to how many permits will be based upon the volume. The more volume, the more permits they could sell.
Could
Zed Wilson?
Thank you, through the chair. I am interested in, for instance, on Edelin Island, how many permits do you issue, and how many are you going to say that can be auctioned off versus either however you sell the permits?
Representative Gash, want to answer that, or should we call it fish and game? Go ahead, Reed.
We know this.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, having formerly represented Petersburg, I'm sure you know a thing or two about Edelin Island. The original bill, version U, took Edelin Island out of the governor's permits. It just eliminated all four of those tags. If you read statute, if you'd like me to, I could. There's four elk in there already. We heard from the Devil's Thumb Archers, who I believe may be online to speak to this, but they were upset about that because this is one of their bread and butter things. They've applied for and received a tag almost every year. There's no guarantee they'll receive a tag, but often many years they've been the only group applying for one of those tags. And so after speaking with them, we decided to just leave those alone like they're in statute right now. So what you see in the bill is reflecting putting the four elk back in, which are already there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Kawasaki?
I was just going to remove my objection to adoption.
Outstanding. Good. So for the record, Representative Kawasaki has removed his objection. Let's continue public testimony. Let's finish up in Fairbanks. Karen Gordon is also online. Ms. Gordon, if you can identify yourself and give us your testimony on 161.
Hi, I'm Karen Gordon, and by way of affiliation, I am on the board of the Wild Sheep Foundation. I am, however, representing myself today.
Okay.
I think this, well, let me back up just a little bit and say that I've been involved with the Wild Sheep Foundation for several years, have at one point written an article about the governor's permit system, and have been paying attention to it in Alaska for many years. I think that this bill is actually a clever scheme to fund a special interest private organization without any benefit to the state, more than what is already coming to the state through the current permit system. Current enabling legislation prescribes profit as the motive to sell these permits. That happened back in 1995. The laws in place provide significant funds back to the state already and are not deficient in that permits are going to the organizations best experienced in doing so. 90% comes back to the state now. Why would we drop it to 70. This doesn't make sense. This bill would preclude permits being sold where they have proven to be the most profitable to the state and instead are intending to generously fund 30% to a private organization. This scheme would have cost the state $52,500 rather than $17,500 on the recent doll sheep permit sold at the Wild Sheep Convention last month. This is where sheep-crazed wealthy hunters congregate to buy permits, specifically these permits that the state has up. And I would say that in the past, the first permit went for $200,000, another one for $200,000 a couple of years ago. This one was $175,000 that went this year. The permit system in place, the wild sheep alone has sold $926,000 worth of state permits since 97. So it's not like this isn't already bringing a bunch of money to the state. I don't see how this new scheme will bring more. This and other organizations now bringing funds to the state by selling or auctioning permits would be precluded from involvement, thus setting up a monopoly without any controls to how funds will be spent, and in fact, funds could be used for political contributions. Safeguards against this are removed with this bill. As to who is in charge of these funds that go to the private organization, their board includes the Commissioner of Fish and Game and other department employees. This is a clear conflict of interest, since the Commissioner, by this legislation, sets the terms of the permits that are awarded, rather than by law, as it appropriately is now. This is a bill that fails entirely to benefit the state and should not proceed any further in any form. I think this scheme will decrease profit to the state over the short and long term, and set up a funding stream from the state to a private organization managed by, in part, several Fish and Game employees. I think this bill is an example of fixing something that's not broken.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gordon. I appreciate your testimony. Representative Gattis.
And if I could, although I can appreciate the last testifier's opinion, I can say that, again, having worked on fundraisers and having been motivated, 30% is far more of a motivator, and I believe that the state will get more money by having more folks be involved at a higher level to gain more money for the state of Alaska. So I would respectfully disagree that 10%, although the Wild Sheep Federation, I believe is their name, have participated in this and done fairly well. I believe that this bill allows folks to participate on a higher level, hence will also, as the state of Alaska, receive higher funding.
Thank you. And with consideration for the other folks who are online to testify, I'll ask for any questions, and seeing none, I'll move on to the next person. Going to Anchorage, online we have Dave Campbell. Mr. Campbell, if you can give us your name for the record and your affiliation, and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Dave Campbell. I'm the donations chairman for the South Central Alaska chapter of the Ruffed Grouse Society. I have been a state resident for just over 47 years. I currently live in Eagle River, and I belong to the Ruffed Grouse Society. I'm a life member of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, a life member of the National Rifle Association, a life member of the Boone and Crockett Association, a life member of the Kwazulu and Natal Hunters and Game Conservation Association, and a life member of the One-Shot Antelope Hunt Club. I'm a member of Trout Unlimited and a member of the Arctic Bird Dog Association. I have supported, and I will continue to support, ethical and legal means of benefit for flora and fauna throughout the world, but especially here in Alaska. I believe with all my heart that House Bill 161 is needed by 501c3 organizations here in Alaska to benefit their individual programs for conservation, legal sport hunting, and sport fishing. This bill would aid immensely the ability of those 501c3 organizations in their fundraising endeavors, as well as increasing funds in the general fund of the state of Alaska. This bill is long overdue for passage in this legislature, in my opinion. And that's about what I have to say. I'm open to any questions that any of you folks have for me.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Questions for Mr. Campbell? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, sir. Moving over there, next to you is Mr. Gary Stevens. In Anchorage, can you hear me, Mr. Stevens?
Yeah, give us your name. I can, yes. My name is Gary Stevens. I live in Chugiak, Alaska. Just for the record, I'm on the board of directors for the Alaska Outdoor Council, have been for about 4 years. I am representing myself at this point. Just a couple comments. The number of permits in this bill going from 19 to, actually I count 46, not 42, including the wolves. I think that that's too many. I think that Wayne Heimer was absolutely correct in his statements about the sheer volume of permits being detrimental. Specifically with bison and doll sheep, as far as the value of those permits that are done in the raffle, on the bison hunts in Delta, traditionally, conservatively, I believe we get over 20,000 applicants a year just for the bison hunts in Delta. And at $10 a permit, that's $200,000. And that's for individual residents and non-residents to go out and enjoy our natural resource, which belongs to all of us. The other issue that I have, and I don't have, unfortunately, we don't have a copy of your CS or your version Y here, but on the first page, line 8 in version A, it says the donation may be made only to a nonprofit corporation established to promote outdoor and conservation programs in partnership with the department. I understand from Lynn Gaddis' comments earlier that the outdoor and conservation program part of it has changed, but if it still says a nonprofit corporation established to promote whatever it is in partnership with the department, I don't know of a organization or a corporation or a C3 anywhere in Alaska that qualifies for that. If there is one, I'd like to know who it is.
Okay. Is that the conclusion of your testimony, Mr. Stevens?
I believe it is, yeah.
Thank you. For the record, to you at the Anchorage LIO, the CS version Y of this bill is available on BASIS. Possibly under documents, but to the folks at the Anchorage LIO and Kenai, Matsu, Delta, and Fairbanks, please, if you can, print out copies and make available those copies to people who want to testify. Any questions for Mr. Stevens, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stevens, I'm just wondering, the two that you mentioned, bison and doll sheep, is that because of this, my understanding from actually a different bill that we worked on, is just there's a lot of disagreement right now about management for doll sheep, for example, and people are not having the hunting experience that they would like to have in terms of, you know, actually finding one to harvest. So is it that kind of existing perceived shortage or management issue that prompted you to say those that one at least and maybe a comment about the bison as well?
In my opinion, it's not a perceived shortage. It's definitely a shortage of opportunity for residents of Alaska primarily, but non-residents of Alaska as well, to participate in hunting doll sheep and or bison in Alaska. Taking 5 permits from those two species out of the limited number of permits that are available to the general public, I think is excessive.
Good deal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. I'm going to go next to the Kenai LIO. In Kenai, if you can hear us, Mr. Mike Crawford. If you can give us your name and affiliation and give us your testimony, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Crawford. I live on the Kenai Peninsula. I'm a regional rep for Safari Club International. I'm also a member of the Legislative Outdoor Heritage Caucus Advisory Committee, and I'm the chair of the Kenai Soldaten Advisory Committee to Fish and Game. I represent two chapters here in Alaska as a regional rep job. They're both award-winning chapters. SCI has over 50,000 members and over 200 chapters. We're a nonprofit organization. We're a leader in defending hunting rights and conservation around the world, the United States, and Alaska. We are certainly in support of this House bill. I think the main objection to this bill, on the people on the outside looking in, would think that maybe we're being greedy. I don't think that's the case. Safari Club International has given over $750,000+. That's what we came up with just off the top of our head without going back and finding all the smaller amounts of money over in the past to fish and game projects and State of Alaska fish and game projects together, including the Wood Bison and Reintroduction Project, the Kenai Peninsula Moose calf survival study just done in the last couple of years, the Kodiak Island chronic wasting disease in the deer, the Kodiak brown bear, project and lots more. We spend more time and money on these tags for a small return, and we're happy to do that. But I'll use the toque tag that we got for Safari Club years ago as an example, where we put it in a Friday auction at our convention, and that tag grew approximately $16,000. And I'll say that just recently, last month or so, the Wild Sheep Foundation sold their same doll sheep tag for $180,000. And some people say, well, that's a lot higher than what they've sold that in the past for. Well, the people that are at that Doll Sheep Foundation that spent $180,000, they also attend the Safari Club Foundation meeting, or the Safari Club convention in Las Vegas. If we were to put that doll sheep tag on a Saturday night event, I think that the amount of money we would have gotten for that tag would have been a much greater number. I'm not saying it would have been $180,000. There's no guarantees in this, but I think we can use that money to further our goal, which has definitely benefited the state of Alaska, the wildlife of Alaska, and the hunters of Alaska. We look forward to advancing conservation and hunters' rights for years to come, and working with Fish and Game and the state on projects that we have yet to see. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Appreciate it. Questions, Mr. Crawford? Representative Seaton, then Tar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out, would you fit under this definition on the Y version, page one? The donation may be made only to a nonprofit corporation established to promote education in outdoor traditions and conservation and wildlife protection programs in partnership with the department, subject to the terms of a memorandum of agreement developed by the department.
Yes, sir, I do believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crawford, I'm just wondering, you know, part of this discussion about the administrative burden for one of the nonprofit organizations and being more motivated to perhaps, you know, do more with the permits, if you had a larger percentage of the proceeds. So would you be interested in support legislation that even if we didn't increase the number of permits, just change that 10% to 30%? Could that have some of the intended positive benefit for the organization?
Yes, I believe it would. We know when we do a fundraiser, we know there's a certain amount of money coming in the room. And if we've got to give 90% of that up, it's more likely that we're going to use something that is going to generate us more income, because after all, it is our fundraiser. And we certainly love to help Fish and Game and the state on conservation projects and issues. And anyway, I'm more than happy to just address the percentage. The greater percentage is the main part here that I'm interested in.
Thank you, Rich. Good deal. We're going to try and get to another question then.
Yes.
Representative Seaton, question.
Looking at the governor's license auction proceeds, we've got, I'm just looking at, let's say, 2011-2012, and it's showing one bison, no moose, musk oxen, a brown bear, and a doll sheep. Now, my understanding is there's 19 permits that are available. Does that mean that your organization or other organizations had the opportunity to get those others and chose not to auction them off? Or I'm trying to understand how, if there's 19 permits available, there's only been, like in 2011-12, only five, it appears, were auctioned off.
I do believe that's the case. It's just, like I said previous, it's we're trying to get the most dollars for our effort, and when we have the ability to make a little more money, it certainly is a more incentive for us to occupy those dollars with a set cost, being the 70% going back to the state in this case.
And that's Mike Crawford for the record, to make sure.
And to follow up, so if instead, and I don't see exactly who these were. Well, most of them were Foundation for North America Wild Sheep. But I'm trying to figure out if there are 19 permits available at 70%, does that mean you would apply for more of those from the governor? Or would you still just probably have one at your fundraiser?
Mr. Crawford.
Yes, sir. Mike Crawford again. We've every year I get an invitation to apply for those tags from Fish and Game, and I've talked to my Safari Club International. I've talked to the people that are running the fundraiser event, our big convention we have every year, and they have declined recently on certain tags just because there wasn't. They didn't think there was enough incentive there to go after. I think the 70% certainly gets everybody's attention and brings us back into the ball game on this. I don't see how this will not generate more income for the state and for Fish and Game. If you sell a car for $100,000 instead of $10,000, well, there's a bigger amount of profit. So it's the same thing here. We're selling a tag, we're selling an opportunity, and we're very good at selling things, and we've got a very great organization, and certainly have a lot of money in the room, and people are willing to pay it for these experiences to share up here in Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. I'm going to turn to your compatriot there, Helen Netschert, who's also with the SCI. If you can hear us, Helen, give us your name and affiliation.
Yes, this is Helen Netschert. I am president of the Alaska Kenai Peninsula chapter of Safari Club International. And I would just like to say we are a club of approximately 200 people down here on the peninsula, and we are 100% volunteer. There is none of our board members are compensated for any of the work that we do. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. This bill will benefit all of our educational and wildlife and conservation efforts down here on the peninsula. And right now, our major ones, of course, are the moose. And we have educational programs for children ages 10 and above that this would benefit, and so we as a club are in favor of House Bill 161, and that's basically all I have.
Thank you, Helen. I appreciate that. Okay. Question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And this is for any of the SCI members there. You don't just sell the tag, do you? Do you package this with a guide, and is it a package deal where, for example, if you sell it at the Las Vegas, does that come with a guide, or you just here's your permit, go? So how do you actually market that, and what are the benefits, I guess, as I'm looking at, other than just the actual permit to the economy of the state?
Well, we market it as a hunt, and then the person who buys the hunt does have to get a guide and their own transportation, and that is in the explanation of the hunt. It is not just set out there to say, oh, here's a hunt for a bison and a bid on it. All the explanations are there. Guide survey and a sheep permit anyway. Let's go back to sheep permits. They have to have a guide if they're from out of state anyway. So you have to have a guide. You have to provide your own transportation and, of course, your own clothing. And, of course, if you get a guide, he's going to provide your food, your housing. And so, yes, it is marketed as a hunt.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Crawford. I think he directed that at Helen and I. There's certainly been times where we have matched this up with a guide and a whole package deal. So that has happened in the past. We don't always do that, but we certainly have done it in the past, and we'll probably do it in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Thank you, Mr. Briefly, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And when you do match those up, how do you break out the cost of the permit versus the cost of the guide and everything else to determine the commission of the state?
Who wants that one?
I'm going to let Mike Crawford answer that.
Go ahead, Mr. Crawford.
Mr. Chairman, we usually try to get the guide to donate 100% of that services. There may be some costs involved that we may cover, but generally speaking, the guide is has donated a majority or all of his services for that. So that's how we work that out.
Okay, thank you very much. Want to keep running through the testimony. I'm going to move to the Mat-Su LAO, Mr. Eddie Grasser. If you can hear us, Mr. Grasser, put yourself on the record and give us your brief testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Grasser. Today, I have a lot of hats, but today I'm representing the Legislative Outdoor Heritage Caucus Advisory Council. Okay. I'm the chairman of the council, and the council represents several major groups here in the state that have seats on the council, including Safari Club International, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, National Rifle Association, and Rough Grouse Society. We support this bill, and we believe it will have great benefits to the state, both for purposes of conservation within and without of the department. It certainly will probably bring more money into the department. And based on my experience with these types of things, over 30 years of fundraising, I'd like to address a couple of points. If you look at version Y, I know there was concern raised about sheep and bison. I believe version Y took the sheep and bison back to the original language of the current statute, except I think we added one sheep. So we're not adding any bison in the current, in the version Y that you have before you. And we did add one doll sheep. And I think you need to understand the marketplace. There's other things to do besides auctions with these permits. You can raffle them. So with species that are prevalent, like moose and caribou, where you can just go hunt them anyway, I mean, yeah, there's some drawing areas that people find desirable, but by and large, you can hunt a caribou almost anywhere in the state if you have the means to get out there. The one area that's popular, because it's on the road system and a lot of people can't afford to fly, is the Neltona Basin, but that's a subsistence Tier 2, Tier 1 area. And those permits aren't available for this type of a permit anyway. But moose and caribou, I mean, if you're going to auction those off, you probably wouldn't get much. But if you could put a package deal together like a moose and caribou hunt and raffle it off, it'd probably be a fairly good fundraising mechanism. Yeah. Esalen Island, I'd like just to reinforce what Representative Gaddis's staff Reed stated. The four permits for Esalen Island elk are already in statute. That's not new. And also, there was a question raised about money going to private organizations. It's probably going to alarm some people, but if you read the actual language of the bill, the 30% has to be spent with consultation by the department. So if Safari Club International, for example, got one of these permits and raised $100,000 and got the 30%, which is $30,000, they still have to go into consultation with the department to see how that 30% is going to be spent. So there's a safeguard there. I can't imagine the department's ever going to say you could spend it on political projects. So I think there's a safeguard there. And as far as benefiting some private organization, the department already has memorandums of agreement with several organizations that I'm aware of. Any organization, 501c3, that qualifies for one of these permits to auction off or raffle off, has the ability to go in and create a memorandum of agreement with the department. There's no exclusionary language that prevents any organization, Wild Sheep, Safari Club, Rough Grouse Society, Alaska Outdoor Council, they all have the opportunity to go in and make a memorandum of agreement with the department to execute that part of the bill. So again, representing those major groups, the Advisory Council, the Legislative Outdoor Heritage Caucus, has made this one of their priority bills for the session. We think it's going to have great benefit to the state of Alaska. And with that, I'll close and entertain any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Grasher. Appreciate your testimony. One brief question, Representative Kawasaki.
Hey, Eddie. This is Scott. I have a question on, I'm new to this bill, so this is the first time I had a chance to see it. But part of the, I think part of the rub that the original version had dealt with being able to use the proceeds to pay expenses associated with lobbying, and I know that you mentioned with your other hat on that you're part of this council that includes groups that do in fact come before the legislature from time to time, and I'm wondering how that first are there objections to that change, and then secondly how that information is audited.
Mr. Grasser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. Again, if you look in on page 2 of the bill, you'll notice that although 30% goes to, say, the Alaska Outdoor Council if they auction one of these permits off, they still have to go into consultation with the department to determine how that 30% is going to be spent.
Sure. Mr. Chairman?
Good deal. Representative Kawasaki.
So I guess the question is how does the department currently do audits to ensure that those monies are not spent on or will not be spent on lobbying?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, you would have to ask the department that question. I don't know what kind of auditing they do.
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, I need to continue on. I got two more folks I'd like to be able to take your vote testimony on this. It's my intention to bring the bill back up again. Hold on to it. But if the folks in the Delta LIO would, I guess, Don Korberg, if you'd like to get on the record, give us your name and affiliation and your testimony briefly, Mr. Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Don Korberg. I've lived in Delta for 38 years. I'm the chair of the Delta Advisory Committee. However, we haven't had any discussion on this bill. I just learned of this hearing this morning, and we just were handed the new version that you folks are talking about, and so we haven't had time to digest that very well either, so I'm just speaking for myself. As I look over the bill, my first concern was supply-side economics, if you will, which we've already talked about. If you saturate the market with permits, the value can only go down. I can't imagine that it wouldn't. It works that way with pretty much everything else. I'd rather not see us get so tied up in the pure economics of this whole scenario. If you notice now, just to apply for a 12 management sheep permit, you've got a 1% chance, which means if you put in at age zero, you might get one permit by the time you become 100 years old. If with that limited amount of tags that we have, we could probably auction them all off. However, the department does have a responsibility to the rest of the citizens of the state, and that's a sustained yield basis for us. And I don't want to lose that. I don't want to just be able to see Warren Buffett and Bill Gates hunting up here in Alaska. This bill provides the commissioner with a lot of options, I guess, and responsibility. And one of the fallacies of our system is that the commissioner is a political appointee, and they change with the governorship, and they may change a little more frequently like that. And with the latitude and the discretion given to them to design how this money is spent, I see that as maybe a warning sign. I would like to see legislation that would maybe create some sideboards, and one of those is on the old page 2, line 13 through 17, where it says, you cannot use that money to contribute to political candidates or for lobbying and supporting ballot propositions and that sort of thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with leaving that in there. I know the Safari Club and the NRA and these larger organizations, and God bless them all, they do a lot of lobbying and they have to, but I would just as soon not see that happen with money from this type of activity. And I also have I'm learning a little bit and I'm listening to you folks. I thought if a person made 10% profit, that was acceptable. But now we're going to 30, and the thing that bothers me probably perhaps even more so is a lot of organizations are able to get pretty creative with their accounting. In fact, we're all getting pretty good at it, and this is the time of year we do because it's tax time. And
I don't know what you're talking about. $100,000
sale, maybe they could come up with $50,000 worth of administrative costs. Who knows? And then they want 25 or 30% of the leftover. I'd rather not see that happen.
Fair enough.
So those are the reservations that I currently have with this.
Okay.
And until those are satisfied, I probably couldn't support this. But I can understand the people that are supporting it, and why maybe an opportunity to increase not only the funding for these organizations that are worthy, nonprofits, and a nonprofit constitutes some benefit to the public. I mean, that's the reason they're nonprofits. It's to help everybody.
Mr. Corbett, thank you very much, sir. Thank you for your testimony. I got you down as a no, largely. Okay, good deal. Continue on. Is Mr. Schmidt in Delta? Is that? Do you want to testify, Mr. Schmidt?
No, thank you.
Okay, good deal. Anybody else in the room wants to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 161. And my intention is to hold the bill over for some more discussion and possible questions by the committee. So thanks to the sponsor, Representative Gaddis, and to Reed for coming before us. I'm going to take a brief at ease and pass the gavel.
We are back on the record. The next next item up on the calendar here is House Joint Resolution 26 relating to OCS revenue sharing. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Members of the committee who are here, thank you for considering HJR 26. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler representing District 12. Oil and gas development in the federal areas can be a boon to our country, providing revenue and jobs and secure sources of domestic energy, but it does also create costly impacts on nearby states, communities, and their residents. While the federal government recognizes these strains, they set policies in place to share proceeds from such development to help states offset the costs for the improvements and services necessary for safe and responsible development. On land, on onshore areas, they share 50% of the revenue with the states where that production occurs. In areas within 3 miles of shore, the near shore, it shares 27% of the revenues, and in offshore areas, namely the states along the Gulf of Mexico, it shares 37.5%. However, Mr. Chairman, current federal law says the state of Alaska and similarly situated states receive 0% share of federal revenues from any oil produced out of prospects in areas such as the Chukchi or Beaufort Seas. Now, many of us believe that there's lots of oil to be had in Alaska's OCS. The industry shares that belief and has invested billions of dollars in leasing, exploration, and drilling. But just as onshore development on the North Slope requires infrastructure investment, investment in the offshore will also require investments in ports, roads, airports, utilities, housing, and more. It will require additional state services such as oil spill and emergency response, environmental monitoring and mitigation, and public health and safety. Mr. Chairman, right now may be our best opportunity in years of seeing progress in OCS revenue sharing. We heard Senator Lisa Murkowski on the floor today. She is the ranking Republican member of the Senate Energy and Resources Committee. And the new chairman is Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, a strong advocate for the oil industry and an advocate for OCS revenue sharing. These two senators have introduced the FAIR Act, Fixing America's Inequities with Revenue. This bill would extend to all OCS states the same 37.5% share that Gulf Coast states now receive. HJR 26 would send a strong message to the state of Alaska, to Congress in support of the FAIR Act or similar legislation that aims at a fair and sensible system of federal revenue sharing. I notice we have a dignitary visiting with us. I would like to yield the floor to public testimony and any questions the committee members might have.
Question from committee. Okay, at this time we will open up public testimony, and we are pleased to have Mayor Charlotte Brower from the North Slope Borough, whose territory is most impacted by the current plans for outer continental shelf drilling. So, Mayor Brower, welcome to the Resources Committee.
Chairman Sadler and Chairman Feige and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here to testify on the HJR 26. Good afternoon. My name is Charlotte Brower. I'm the mayor of the North Slope Borough. And foremost, I am a wife of a whaling captain and mother of 6 children and grandmother of 25. And so I have a dear investment in the North Slope. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on HJR 26, a resolution urging the United States Congress to provide for sharing with local areas the revenue from the oil and gas development on our outer continental shelf. On July 23rd of this past summer, I was invited to testify before the U.S. Senate Energy Committee in support of Senate 1273, known as the Fixing America's Inequities with Revenues Act of 2013, or FAIR Act. Today I'm here to speak before you to express support for HJR 26 as a way to help secure passage of measures like Senate 1273 in Washington, D.C. By working together as Alaskans, we need to send a message for receiving a fair and equitable distribution of revenues that come from energy development on our Outer Continental Shelf OCS. Congress should pass legislation to ensure that the state and local governments will have resources to keep up with infrastructure requirements, expand emergency response and search and rescue capabilities, take an active role in oil spill preparedness, and work to maintain healthy communities and a healthy ecosystem. The North Slope Borough is the largest municipality in the United States, encompassing over 94,000 square miles, including more than 8,000 miles of Arctic coastline along the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. The majority of the North Slope residents are Inupiat Eskimos. We are heavily dependent on marine mammals, such as bowhead and beluga, whales, seals, and walruses, to sustain our physical health and our cultural and spiritual well-being. The importance of subsistence in our coastal communities and marine environment goes beyond the need for food. Our unique Inupiat culture, our traditions, and our links to our ancestors and history are also tied to our subsistence lifestyle, to our custom of sharing with others and to celebrating our connection to the land and the ocean. We are mindful of the critical need to protect the environment and preserve our culture and our resources. However, we also recognize that our ability to continue to provide even basic services to our communities depends upon revenue from oil and gas industry, which today primarily operates on state land in our region. Without these revenues, the North Slope Borough would not be able to maintain the airstrips, healthcare facilities, water and sewer, search and rescue, or other services we provide in our villages. What many people in the lower 48 do not understand is that the infrastructure enjoyed today by other coastal states, paved roads, deep water ports, and modern communications, those don't exist in the North Slope region. Most people do not understand the challenges of Alaska's rural governments face. As one example, of gallon of milk costs $10 today in Barrow, that same gallon of milk might cost $18 or more in some of our villages. Other food items such as fresh fruits and vegetables are even more expensive relative to the lower 48 or even other parts of Alaska. Why? Because the cost of transportation in our region is very high. And now imagine the cost of the North Slope Borough for new roads, upgrades to airstrips, new healthcare facilities, or new water and sewer or gas lines that must be built through permafrost. We also face threats to the infrastructure we have in place today. With the Arctic Ocean now ice-free for a longer period of time every spring and fall, storms are eroding the land around our villages, in some cases 5 to 6 feet per year. Once moderate storm consumed more than $1 million in response costs from our borough. Over the last 10 years, the coastline near Barrow has receded toward an old landfill that holds tens of thousands of barrels of Navy and Air Force waste. 10 years ago, the ocean was 200 feet away from the landfill. Now it is only 120 feet away. Coastal erosion also threatens Barrow's utility system, which is an underground system of tunnel designed to protect the city's utilities from the cold. This system provides indoor plumbing to our residents and eliminates the needs for outhouses and water delivery by truck. And like most other things in the Arctic, it is very expensive. I would also like to note that the oil and gas industry, researchers, and federal agencies, including the U.S. Coast Guard, all use our local infrastructure, our airports and roads and hospitals. We welcome people to our community, and we are grateful for the Coast Guard's presence in Barrow during the 2012 drilling season. But Congress must recognize the cost of our community of maintaining and expanding critical infrastructure as industry develops offshore resources. There is also a great need of scientific research needed to understand how best to mitigate the impact of oil and gas development on the Arctic environment, and the North Slope Borough can and should be part of that effort. The last thing I would like to emphasize is the role of the state and local governments in emergency preparedness associated with offshore energy development, including oil spill response. Let us pray that our good Lord will prevent the need. But in the event of an emergency, it will be the brave men and women from the North Slope Borough Search and Rescue Department and the Alaska Department of Public Safety's troopers and the village PSOs who will most likely be first on the scene. In summary, the people of the North Slope live in one of the most undeveloped regions in our nation. Investments must be made in the infrastructure necessary to ensure that the OCS development can be conducted safely and responsibly. And the burden of providing such infrastructure should not fall solely on the people that have the most to lose in the case of an oil spill. Thank you for sponsoring HJR 26 to help the people of the North Slope Borough send this message to the United States of Congress.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Any questions from committee for Mayor Brower? Representative Sadler?
Not so much a question as a comment. It certainly is appropriate and welcoming to see Browers and Yupik Sounds in the resources room when we're discussing the impact of OCS on the North Slope. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? Hearing none. Online, we have two individuals. First up from Anchorage, Sarah Erkman from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Hi, this is Sarah.
Ms. Erkman, please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Chairman Sadler, Chairman Feige, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Sarah Erkman, and I'm the External Affairs Manager for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. In short, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, or AOGA, supports House Joint Resolution 26. AOGA is the business trade organization representing the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, transporters, and marketers in Alaska. With 15 member companies, we represent both large and small companies with interest on the North Slope, in the Cook Inlet, as well as in the offshore. We appreciate the focus on developing our offshore resources in a way that recognizes Alaskans' interest in advancing this issue, because the offshore is what we call the next generation of oil and gas development in Alaska. With more than 27 billion barrels of oil to produce, it is truly a world-class resource. AOGA can say at a high level that we support an OCS revenue-sharing program as long as any additional costs are not passed on to the offshore oil and gas industry in the form of bonuses, rent, or royalties. We appreciate the representative's effort to keep the offshore revenue-sharing idea alive at the federal level, as well as that of our congressional delegation, which has made similar efforts on the national level. To thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I am happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Erkman. Any questions from committee? Ms. Erkman, thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we'll go to Washington, D.C., Adrian Herrera.
Hello, committee, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead, Mr. Herrera.
All right, thank you very much, Chairman Feige, Chairman Sadler. For the record, my name is Adrian Herrera. I'm the D.C. coordinator for Arctic Power. Arctic Power is a 501c6 not-for-profit citizens-based organization arguing for the environmentally responsible development of oil and gas resources in the Arctic of Alaska. We strongly support HDR 26 and support for OCS revenue sharing nationwide as well as in the state. Two prime reasons: to bring parity with the rest of the nation, particularly the Gulf of Mexico states, which receive 37.5%, and also to mitigate against impacts to coastal communities in Alaska and to the state as a whole. Currently, the status of 0% revenue sharing does nothing to include to encourage the state of Alaska nor any other coastal state to pursue development off its shores, nor does it provide for any mitigation against any problems or impact to the environment or coastal communities as a whole. As mentioned by Chairman Sadler and also by the Honorable Mayor Brower, we have a bill in Congress, the FAIR Act, S-1273, which is probably the prime target that HDR 26 will be used up against. But there is actually a second bill, and that is S-199 by our very own Senator Begich. The S-199 bill is carrying much the same wordage as Lisa Murkowski and Senator Landrieu's bill on revenue sharing, with the exception that it is geographically limited to the state of Alaska. Nonetheless, it receives strong support. Senator Begich has, as a notion to the fact that Senator Landrieu's bill by seniority will probably be the bill that is moved through committee, has signed on as a sponsor of Senator Landrieu's bill. So in that regard, we have full Alaskan support for all of the OCS revenue sharing bills currently active in the U.S. Senate. Just for your information, in the U.S. House last year, we had H.R. 2231 passed, which is an OCS revenue sharing bill carrying the exact same numbers of 37.5% to the state closest to development. And that was passed by Chairman Hastings, the chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, who is the representative from Washington's 4th District. Back to the FAIR Act and actually the HDR 26 and its purpose. From our perspective down in D.C., we are really up against the views of the White House, which has expressed some very strong concerns against revenue sharing towards states that currently don't receive it, such as Alaska. And those two concerns are based on two fronts. The first is the very obvious loss of revenue to the U.S. Treasury, the figure of 37.5% taken out of the entire pie that is developed from OCS royalties and revenues going to the state in question is a loss to the U.S. Treasury. There's no doubt. You can't really argue against that fact. Similarly, under the current scheme, and remember the current scheme is based on a bill from 2006 called the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act, or GOMESA for short, drafted by Mary Landrieu, ironically, the very same person who's drafting the FAIR Act. That bill allows for 37.5% to the local communities up to a cap of $500 million per year. The FAIR Act reduces that cap down to zero at the year 2025. And the Treasury and the White House has viewed this as, again, a lack or for less or a better word, stealing money from the Treasury. And during the committee hearing, we heard senators actually stating this fact as one of their concerns against revenue sharing. The other front that's mentioned by the White House and the Department of Interior has to do with environmental mitigation programs, and specifically the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is mentioned in HDR 26. The Land and Water Conservation Fund so far has been really a bit of a boondoggle. It's been raided by various presidents over the last 20 years, rated by various committees in Congress to fund other projects not even related to environmental conservation or environmental mitigation. The president currently wants the LWCF funded at $900 million. Under GOMESA, it receives $125 million, and under the FAIR Act, it will receive $62.5 million. Having said that, during debate on the FAIR Act itself last year in July, now current Chairman Landrieu and Ranking Member Murkowski both stated for the record LWCF should not be reduced. But it is our opinion, our power, that the President's wishes for a $900 million funding for future from future OCF revenue for LWCF is really pie in the sky. It would never get that sort of support through Congress. At any rate, it is one of their bones of contention, and we support the clause in H.R. 26 that addresses this. On the opposite side of the coin, just for your information, the viewpoints put forth by the delegation, both Senator Begich and Murkowski, and by now Chairman Landrieu, in favor of revenue sharing, and this applies directly to what H.J.R. 26 says. The first point is to bring parity between onshore development, which receives 50% from federal lands going towards the state, parity between the Gulf of Mexico under the GOMESA Act of 2006, which receives 37.5%, and parity between the entire nation as a whole. Why does one state receive some money and yet another state, like the state of Alaska, which has more coastline, more rural areas, closer to development than any other state, receive nothing at all? So that's the first point. The second point brought up by the delegation during the hearing was because of impact. And this is perhaps Ranking Member Murkowski's biggest point. Eloquent Mayor Charlotte Brower mentioned this. You know, everybody talks about the benefit and the jobs that a state will accrue from offshore development. What about the impact? Who pays for that? And if you have 0% revenue sharing, the state is beholden to mitigate and against any impact. The local community, such as the North Slope Borough, is beholden to mitigate any impact. Just take, for example, transportation hubs. You know, does Point Barrows Airport have the ability to take the capacity for having three or four operators offshore? Just the physical capacity of basic utilities, as Mayor Brower pointed out, does it have the ability to handle water demands and electric demands of any development taking place offshore? As Ranking Member Murkowski said, it doesn't matter if it's 1 mile offshore or 50 miles offshore. The impact to the shoreline is still very, very high. And the very last point is really against the White House itself. The White House, in our opinion, takes a very myopic view to this in that it doesn't look at the big picture. If you increase the attractiveness of development by allowing for infrastructure to be built on the shoreline, more companies will absolutely take the advantage of that and develop offshore. If you have greater development offshore, you have greater revenue streams. And under the FAIR Act, under GOMESA, you have a greater stream towards environmental mitigation. The FAIR Act allows for 10% of the entire OCS revenue nationwide to be spent by coastal communities on environmental mitigation and also alternative energy development. And we think this addresses the President's, the White House, and the Department of Interior's views. And we appreciate HJR 26 addressing this issue. This concludes my testimony. If you have further questions for me, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Herr. Questions from committee? Is there anybody else online to testify? Anybody else in the room that would like to testify? Okay, at this time, we will close public testimony and open this to discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move this.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would, without objection, I just lost my screen, move that H.J.R. 26 move out of committee with individual recommendations and zero physical note.
Hearing no objection, H.J.R. 26 is so moved. Representative Johnson?
I would like to take a vote. I object. I want to vote on this.
Oh, I'll object for you.
Thank you.
Hearing an objection from Representative Seaton, will the clerk please call the roll?
Okay. To
to report House HJR 26.
Mr. Chairman, can we have just a brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
Okay. Representative Hawker is absent. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Wilson? Absent. Representative Tarr? Absent. Representative Kawasaki? Absent. Co-Chair Feige?
Yes.
Co-Chair Sadler?
Yes.
Okay. 5 yeas, 0 nays.
Okay, by a vote of 5-0, the HR 26 will pass out of committee. Are there any other questions from committee? In that case, we are adjourned till 1 o'clock on Friday.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you, sir.